And I think I'm the only syndicator out of 4,000 syndicators in North America that does deals all cash, no mortgage. I can't even find anybody else who does it. I'm better at being an expert in one thing, in one place, in one asset class, very similar kind of properties where I could understand the entire market. And it's all doing one thing in one part of town, just here, 8% returns, cash on cash, no mortgage, safe. I'm into radical risk aversion.
Welcome to the Source of Commercial Real Estate podcast, where we talk to the experts in all asset classes of commercial real estate. Listen so you can grow your wealth, expand your portfolio, improve your mindset, and live an amazing life. And now, your host, Jonathan Hayek.
Welcome to the Source of Commercial Real Estate, where we talk to the experts in non-residential commercial real estate so you can grow your business, find a competitive advantage, and live the life that you want. I am your host, Jonathan Hayek, and today I am talking with Joel Friedland of Britt Properties. Joel has a 42-year track record in industrial real estate. He co-founded Epic Savage Realty Partners in 1991, where he oversaw hiring and mentoring 60 industrial real estate professionals, many of whom became his partners. His group sold the firm to an international real estate company in 2014, and then Joel started Britt Properties. As an industrial real estate broker and owner, Joel has secured over 2,000 industrial property leases and sales, totaling over $2 billion in brokerage volume and $250 million in acquisitions. His greatest accomplishment is maintaining valued relationships with brokers, tenants, and investors spanning 5 decades. He does fully syndicated deals, often with 0% debt, an unheard-of approach in real estate, which caters to his wealthy investor base, primarily concerned with conservation of principal. We are definitely going to get into his zero debt strategy. His experiences during the Great Recession in 2008 have informed his investment approach to be hyper-conservative while still allowing an 8% cash-on-cash return plus upside for his investors. Joel attended the University of Michigan. He enjoys playing golf, spending time with his family, particularly his 3 young grandchildren. Joel, I am honored. I consider it a privilege to have you here with me. How are you doing today?
Great, Jonathan. It is my privilege to join you today.
Thank you for being here. And I just talked a little bit about your background, and I figured we would start this conversation by framing it in terms of the Great Financial Crisis in 2008 to 2010. I've done a lot of research on you. I've heard you on multiple podcasts, and it seems like this time period was instrumental in forming Britt Properties and your investment strategy today. So why don't we start out by you telling us about your experience in the Great Financial Crisis? Kind of frame it in terms of what was your investing like before the Great Financial Crisis? What happened to you during the GFC, and what does your investing look like now?
Yeah, so it's a painful episode that I'm going to tell you about. What happened was I've been through 4 different downturns, starting in 1981. I started in a terrible, terrible recession. In 81, interest rates were 17% or higher. And I was working for the people who mentored me, a family called the Podolskys in Chicago that had a half billion dollar portfolio, 6 million square feet of industrial. And I was so lucky. They were like family to me, even though I wasn't a member of the family. There were 2 sons and a daughter, and their 84 buildings were my learning ground. And they taught me everything that they possibly could about owning, leasing, managing, and syndicating industrial real estate. So when I figured out I couldn't become a member of their family, they weren't willing to adopt me. We still loved each other. I left and I started a brokerage firm and an acquisition and syndication and management firm with 3 other people. And we built it to what I considered to be very large, super successful, cocky Joel. I was like, it was working. I forgot about the real bad 17% interest rates. I forgot about debt being dangerous. And I was like the frog in water that you turn the flame on and it starts boiling and it doesn't realize until it's boiled that the water was getting hot. So I had acquired about 80 industrial buildings myself with my group. And in 2008, I had 50 buildings. We had sold 30. I had 7 banks. I had guarantees on 50 loans. I had done my own little mezz fund. I had guarantees on that to 62 individual people. And in September of 2008, I was watching CNBC as the market was crashing, and I realized it would never be the same again. And I figured out within a month that the values of our properties were not nearly what I thought they were. They dropped literally in a day. And the banks eventually, I knew, were going to come to me and say, hey, your loan-to-value ratios are too high because the values are down. And that's exactly what happened. The banks came to me and said, if you're going to renew this loan and this loan and this loan, because we had 50 buildings, they were coming up every month. I was asked to pay down debt. Never heard of such a thing. And one of the banks wouldn't even renew, and I had to go to other banks to get them to take on the new loan. But every one of them looked at my portfolio, and they kept saying, we need a portfolio analysis with everything on there about everything you have. And it was almost impossible to do anything because the bankers were in a panic and people were being put into workout. I don't know if you know what a forbearance agreement is, but I certainly do now. That's where they agree to postpone the loan and take less payments, but you're going to owe it later and you're just in as much trouble later if it doesn't work out. They just buy you a little time. They called it extend and pretend. Workout people have no sense of humor, and I ended up feeling so ashamed. I felt like I thought I was doing a great job, but my investors were getting letters from me, and I was communicating once a month. Things are bad. It's tough. There's risk of loss, and I went into a downward spiral and fell into this devastating state of depression, and I can't begin to tell you what a gift that was to the current Joel from the old Joel, because it's like a kid putting his hand on the electric stove when it's very hot, and you know it just melts into the stove, and the hand is burned, and he'll never do that again. Well, that's what happened to me, and it informed my analysis. Why did we have so much trouble? Well, I worked my way out of it. Ended up actually doing pretty well years later, but it took years to recover. And I decided that the common link with the 9 buildings out of the 100 that I've had that I've lost money on, the common link was debt. That's what I figured out. So I decided to stop using debt. And I think I'm the only syndicator out of 4,000 syndicators in North America that does deals all cash, no mortgage. I can't even find anybody else who does it.
Joel, I want to juxtapose the conversation. That was a great start. Can you tell us about Britt Properties? What kind of deals are you doing now? What's an ideal deal for you that you're doing right now?
Okay, so we are laser focused on Chicago. Back, another thing that I figured out when things were rough was that I'm better at being an expert in one thing, in one place, in one asset class, very similar kind of properties where I could understand the entire market. So Chicago's got 16,000. We've grown by 1,000 buildings in the past 7 years. We have 16,000 buildings making up 1.5 billion square feet, which was 1.3 billion a number of years ago. So there's been a lot of development of these very large boxes, which we don't do, by the way. We just do Class B smaller buildings. And I figured out that my niche and also the place where I can get the highest returns for my investors are on smaller buildings that are occupied by manufacturers in the city or right near O'Hare Airport. Nothing way out in the hinterlands, the far out suburbs. I used to, where you grew up in Naperville, I had three buildings in the industrial park off of Deal Road. And I had three buildings in Aurora off of Route 59. So you remember those locations? I still have one of those. I've got a building in Meridian Business Campus, which is over by Liberty Street and 59, 20,000 square feet. But I'm just not interested in getting beaten up in somebody else's realm. My realm is where I know the most, and I'm not going to make a mistake there like somebody else might who's a rookie or who hasn't done this for 40 years. So my market knowledge is intense. My relationships are deep. And it's all doing one thing in one part of town, just here, 8% returns, cash on cash, no mortgage, safe, safe, safe. I'm into radical risk aversion.
Is that property in Aurora, is the tenant there still Feed My Starving Children?
Yes, it is. Look at you.
I've been in that building. So for listeners that don't know, I grew up in the Chicago suburbs in Naperville. Aurora is right next to Naperville. Aurora, I think, is the second largest city in Illinois. And so Feed My Starving Children, non-for-profit, they bag this food for developing countries all over the world. And it's been a while, but I have been there and I've put all the food in this bag in your property. So I was looking at your portfolio and I saw that and I'm like, huh, Joel owns that building with Feed My Starving Children. So very cool. Joel, take
and
me back.
Can I tell you one more thing?
Please.
We've owned it for 30 years, actually 34 years. And we've had many tenants in there. We had Maytag in there before Feed My Starving Children. And I just love this. It's 20,000 feet. It's such a great size.
Tons of users for buildings of that size. Take me back to 2008 to 2010. You've had, what'd you say, 50 loan guarantees with banks, 62 individual guarantees with private investors. You said you wanted to crawl into a hole and just cry. You may have done that for a period of time. I know you spent some time on that couch behind you, but you came out the other side. You're here. And you said that you're better off for it. So walk me through getting through the other side. What happened to some of those properties that you were upside down on? And how did you make that transition to crawling out of the hole and being better for it on this side?
It was incredibly difficult. As I said, it's just so hard when the facts go against you. You can't change the facts. You have to deal with it. And it's really interesting. I got counseling. I found a meditation class. A friend of mine just lost his mother, and he was equally depressed over a personal loss like I was over my business disaster. And I just figured out that sitting around on the couch, lying on the couch, was not going to solve the problem. So I got up, I dusted myself off, and I went to work. And the only way out of a depression is work. I can tell you that my experience and watching other people, lying around and wallowing in it doesn't bring you out. It just makes it worse. It spirals down. So I got to work, and it was difficult. Waking up in the morning, sleeping was tough, anxiety every night. I'd wake up at 3 a.m. in a cold sweat. Because I really thought I might lose the whole portfolio, and it was worth a couple $100 million. And I had put all of my favorite people, my business relationships, my family, and my friends into the syndications. And it took a long time. It was a lot of hard work. I can't even begin to tell you how bad it was with my brothers who were with me in business, because I was the older brother and I felt like I let them down at that time. So what I did was I did an analysis of what went wrong. And this is something I think you've heard from me before. When you hear that someone tells you they're a deal junkie, That's a bad thing. Junkies are not the kind of people that you want to invest with. The word junkie, would you invest with someone who's deeply into a drug or alcohol addiction, that's life is falling apart, probably has a bunch of character flaws, probably doesn't tell the truth all the time to everybody? I figured out that real estate, like the stock market, like other types of gambling, sports, casino, real estate could become something akin to an addiction for someone who has access to money and wants to play in the real estate game. Like, you know what really upsets me now? Because I don't gamble. I've given it up. I've drawn a line. My line in the sand is no gambling. No gambling in sports, no gambling in the casino, and no gambling in real estate. And that is my credo, and I'm sticking with it. I went to my accountant and I said, I'm going to start doing deals all cash, no mortgage. And he said, you can't do that. Real estate's a leverage business. I said, I'm going to do it. He said, you won't get any investors. No one will do it. I've never heard of it. And I said, I'm doing it anyway. And I did. And I now have a new accountant. So that's how strongly I felt, regardless of what anybody was going to tell me about not doing it. Because I don't want to go back, Jonathan, to that place that I was with the shame and the feelings of inadequacy and of loss and of depression. So I'm interested in avoiding that pain, and I'm interested in sleeping well at night. And my investors are usually people who are not trying to get rich. They're people who are trying not to lose the money that they've worked so hard to make.
You've touched on the zero debt strategy a couple times now, so I'm going to push you on a little bit. And to be clear, I'll preface these questions with saying I really admire your strategy, but I imagine you've received a lot of pushback on the strategy, because in real estate circles, not using debt is basically heresy. All of the gurus and the books and the YouTube talking personalities are going to say, this is why real estate is amazing, because you can use debt on it. And so to actively choose to not use debt is insane. That is one of the huge benefits of using real estate. So talk to me more about your all cash strategy. First, I want to clarify, is this a hard and fast rule? You never do any debt, or are there some exceptions? Do you do some low loan to value loans? Can you clarify the strategy a little bit first?
Good question. Yeah. So I have a lot of legacy properties from 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. And our average, we have 19 properties right now, and our average loan-to-value ratio is 17% across the board. It's my goal to do at least every 3 out of 4 acquisitions with zero debt. And I'll take debt up to 30%, but not a penny more than 30% loan-to-value ratio. And in my PPMs, in the rule book, that when people see it and they say, I'm looking at this, and I understand it, it says the maximum amount of debt is 30% loan-to-value ratio. It's hard and fast. But the only reason that I would do a loan on a deal is because of the size. If a deal, my typical deal size is about $3 million to buy an existing freestanding single-tenant building. And on a $3 million deal, I have a little fund that I put together with a group of people, and we buy the buildings in advance before syndicating them, all cash. And then we syndicate them after we own them. We call that Brit co-sponsors. And it's a group of 40 of us who put up this money. It's about $5 million. We buy the building all cash, and then we syndicate it out 100%. But here's what happened. I ran into a really, really great deal. This past year, I closed in October 19th on a 3-building package that was $13 million. And what's interesting is I figured out I can't raise $13 million before closing even with my $5 million, I couldn't do it. So I went to the bank and I talked to Jay Dice at Union National Bank of Elgin, where I have all my loans except for one, which is at Highland Park. And I said to Jay, I need 30% on this $13 million deal. He says, well, that's $3.9 million. I said, yep. He said, but I want to be able to pay it off in a year without a penalty if I can syndicate that out. So he did that. He loaned us the $3.9 million, and that's exactly 30% of $13 million. I don't want to do that again, but if I find another great deal where I can't raise that money that fast, because we don't do funds, we just do deal by deal by deal. If I had a fund, I could have just closed. Funds are dangerous because it gives you discretion. In my case, one more safety thing that I do is I have a group of advisors. I have eight individuals, including Steve Podowski, who are people that I go to for all kinds of advice. But before I buy a building, I have a meeting with those eight. And I say, throw me your toughest questions about why we shouldn't do this deal. And they do. And every one of them tries to trip me up, and I love it, because that's exactly what you need to do impeccable due diligence. So yeah, I would rather do no deals with debt. And I'm not against debt. I'm against debt for me. You can do it. The other 3,999 syndicators in North America, they can all do it. I'm not against it. And I even think my investors should invest, not just with me, they should diversify. But in my deals, if they're looking for something with radical safety, I'm happy to show them how it works. And I want to be a small part of their portfolio, the same way they should have some bonds and they should have some stocks and they should have some treasury bills. And that's how I look at it. It's just, do you know, I'll ask you a question. Do you know what it takes in terms of net worth to be in the top 1% in the United States?
Oh, I think I've probably seen this recently. Top 1%, I don't know, got to be around $3
million.
$11 million.
$11 million. So the way that it works is the top 1% is $11.5 million today. There's statistics on it. The top 5% have over $4 million. And then, so you can imagine the gradation from 5 to 4, maybe 4 is $6 million, and maybe 3 is $7.5 million. But my investors are primarily the 1%ers. And I tell them, you should never, ever go into one of my deals with more than 3% of your investable net worth, because diversification is really important. And you're not going to make a fortune on my stuff. Maybe you'll make a 14 IRR with a, if we hold the building for 10 years and you make an average of 9% yield a year, maybe there's an extra 5% a year after the hold period. Maybe it goes up 50% net. And that's my mantra is, be smart, be diversified, use good judgment. And if you want to go into my stuff, I'd love to have you. If you want me to take a lot of risk and try to make you 20% IRRs, wrong guy.
So you're comfortable with saying a high net worth limited partner coming to you and saying, Joel, 14%, I mean, you got to be able to do better than that. I mean, I'm getting, you know, these multifamilies are projecting 20, 25% IRRs. You're comfortable telling these passive investors, hey, you know what, if that's your expectation, this deal is not for you. I'm projecting 14% best case. It might take a decade to get there, but it's going to be super safe. And so if you're looking for 20%, these deals are simply not for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen so many offerings where the projections are these huge multiples in short periods of time. First of all, we're long-term holders. You can't make a gigantic IRR if you hold something for 10 years. You just can't do it. The math's impossible. And so I don't really get, in my case, at my age, I'm 64, when I find the perfect building, you know how hard it is to find a building that's got the right size, the right location, the right ceiling height, the right number of docks, the parking in the exact right place in the front and on the side, not in the back. Because, you know, people don't want to walk around in the rain and snow parking in the back. If I find a building that's got parking in the back, it's a no. It's got to have parking on the side near the front door and in the front of the building, or very, very similar to that. So, you know, I've got these specifications that make a building fantastic. And if I find a fantastic building, why am I selling it in 3 years? Yeah, I could, and I probably could get 25% IRRs, but then I got to go find a replacement building. How do you replace that great building? Where do you find the next great one?
So, Joel, if some of these properties are legacy properties, and I know you're opportunistic, and so they're not all legacy properties. Some, you know, if it makes sense, I know you'll sell quickly, but I imagine your underwriting is this is a very long-term hold. How do your investors get their capital back if these are potentially hold forever properties?
Well, here's the good news. They don't want it back. They like the deals. I've tried to pry some of my stuff out of the hands of my old investors because there's something called Rule 144. If you're offering securities, you're doing it where you go on a podcast or you advertise or meet people you don't know, you have to do a 506C, which is part of the securities laws. You can't do a 506B, where you can have people who are non-accredited, up to 35 of them. I do these 506Cs. Everybody has to be accredited. And it's selling securities. Once I've heard people say, if you have five partners, it's not securities. That's bullshit. That's illegal. That's wrong. Two partners is securities. Talk to any securities lawyer. If you want to stay out of jail, don't pretend that you know something that the lawyers say is not true. So it's selling securities. But my lawyer, Mark Roderick in Philadelphia, taught me something, which is if I've had a property for a long period of time, and the rule is actually just 1 year, and an investor wants to get out, I can bring a new investor to take out the old investor, and it's not considered selling securities. And I do that frequently for people who want liquidity. It especially applies to families where grandpa invested and died. And now the kids get the investment in my stuff and they say, Joel, how do I get out of this? I said, well, the good news for you is the way that the tax laws work is that when grandpa died, you got to step up in value, which means if you sell your stuff that you inherited of my properties, you pay zero tax. If grandpa had sold it, he would have had to pay tax. So you get this great tax benefit by waiting until he dies. And Rebecca, you're the daughter. Your dad, I love David. I loved your dad. I understand you don't want to own this $100,000 worth of this stuff. I have this friend. His name is Mark. He lives in Palm Springs, and he will buy you out for the $100,000. I arrange it. It's a one-page document called Acceptance of Assignment of Membership Interest. I put the paper together. I have both sign it. Rebecca gets a check from Mark, and Rebecca's out, and that's how they get liquidity. And then that's called recapitalization on a very small scale, and we get to keep the property for the other, say, 40 investors that love it because they like this. It started out making an 8% return, and now we've had it for 7 years, and it's making 9.5%, and our tenant stays forever because it's a sticky industrial tenant. Our average tenant stays for 18 years. And the rent goes up almost every year. Who would want to sell that? Yeah, I think I'll sell my 9.5% return and pay taxes and then find something else better to do with it. People don't do that. I can't pry it away from them. They like it so much. So I've got this guy, Mark, in Palm Springs is saying, can you get someone out where I can get something from some of your legacy properties? And I've been unable to get anybody to sell. And I have 200 investors. I can't get anyone to get out. Which I guess is good.
Joel, I want to get you on another part of your business strategy that I imagine you might get some pushback on. I own single-tenant industrial properties, and I love the asset class. I know you own single-tenant industrial properties. I know you also own multi-tenant industrial properties. For your single-tenant industrial properties, when someone, whether it's an investor or just some random person says single tenant, what if it goes vacant? What are you going to do when that property goes vacant? Why would you buy a single tenant property when you could buy a multi-tenant property? What's your defense of single tenant industrial properties?
Okay, I have three answers. The first one is the tenants who move into a single tenant property are usually manufacturers. Just by the nature of what they are, they're Class B buildings. Chicago is a market, it's an industrial market where there's a lot of manufacturers who supply the aerospace business, the automotive business, the computer business. We have thousands of manufacturers, and they love freestanding buildings because they don't have to share a wall. They don't have to share parking. They don't have to worry about anything making noise. They love having their customers come, and it looks like they own the building even though they're a tenant. So I love the freestanding buildings, and so do my tenants. I'll get a deal over any neighbor that's a multi-tenant building when a tenant's looking around if I'm freestanding. I just have an advantage. They're more desirable. Secondly, the management is simple. It's not easy to manage a property, but it's so much simpler to have a tenant that pays the taxes, insurance, maintenance, and utilities, and we get the rent, and they take care of everything, except we're responsible for the roof. Tenants don't take the roof. There's no such thing as triple net. That is bull. Tenants don't take the roof. If you get a dumb enough tenant to take the roof, they're not going to stay in business because they're dumb. So there's no such thing as triple net. It's really modified net. And sometimes the tenant makes us take the HVAC replacements, and they'll amortize the cost of it over the remaining term of their lease. So that makes it less net also. But it's really easy because they cut the grass, they get the alarm in their own name, they're in charge of the sprinkler system, fire protection inspections, they have to order them, they pay the water, they pay the sewer. So they're really easy. But the really most important one is, in a giant market like ours, there are very few buildings that come on the market for sale in our category of Class B small industrial, and no one's building them. Replacement cost, including land, would be $240 a foot. And we buy most of our buildings these days for about $100 a foot. And here's the kicker. A user, if my tenant leaves, will buy the building for a 40% premium over what I could have gotten if I sold it as a leased building on a cap rate. Why? It's a tool for their business. It doesn't matter what they pay. If a company's doing $20 million in business and they're making $3 million net and they're two doors away and they want to grow, they can't afford to move. They can't move their equipment. They can't lose their well-trained people. They can't move. But they can buy a building, if it's available, two doors away where they can walk back and forth. And that's what I got. So we have 19 buildings. We've sold 81 of the 100 buildings. 75 of those have been sold to users. And it's between a 35 to 45% premium because they can't say no.
Yeah, it makes sense. If there's a potential of you selling that property, there's some uncertainty for that tenant. And so the tenant more than likely wants to stay. And if a new owner comes in, that tenant is out of control, you know, doesn't have control of their tenancy. Do you think that's a big reason why the tenant gets so interested in purchasing it?
You know, it's once you get rich and if you own a business and you have nothing but money, you don't want to piss the money away in rent. That's what my people tell me. It's like, why would I piss away the money in rent? I can buy the building. And like you, Joel, I know it'll go up in value and I'll get a mortgage and I'll pay down the mortgage. It'll pay for itself. I think it's great for a user to get a mortgage. They're paying the rent. They know they're not going to ever leave. So, and if they do, they sell the building. So the user sale strategy is our secret sauce. We like to buy buildings from families who used to own the business. They sold the business to a private equity group and they keep it. until the next generation of children or grandchildren want to get rid of each other, and that's when we buy it from the family.
Joel, let's get into some deals. You closed a deal earlier in 2023. I heard you mention that it's right along the Chicago River, great location in the area of progress and development. Will you take me through that deal? What'd you like about it, and what are you going to do with it?
Sure. That's a great one. That's the $13 million deal where I borrowed the $3.9 million. I raised the other nine-ish million. So a young broker named Nick Stellis, who I had never met before, found out who I was. I don't know where he found me. And he said, I know you buy small manufacturing industrial buildings in Chicago. I've got a package of three buildings owned by a family, and I'd like to bring it to you and have you take a look at it. It's at Belmont and Western on the Chicago River, debatably one of the nicest neighborhoods in Chicago that's not like the Gold Coast or the Magnificent Mile. It's a north side location. Families live there. There are these homes around it and townhomes that are seven-figure, million-dollar homes, literally across the street from these buildings. And I went and I looked at this thing and I said, it's 5 acres, three buildings, 1,200 feet on the river. And I said, this thing's going residential one day. Someone's going to tear these down one day and make them into condos with a water feature on the river. And I brought my partner Eric to see it. And I brought Sam, my son, and I brought five or six of the members of my advisory board. And they all said, you better buy this. This is a must. So we negotiated for 2.5 years. We offered them $11 million and they were at $15 million. Now remember, we ended up at $13 million. How did that happen? So we negotiated a lot and we got to know the tenant. The tenant is called Tampico. One of the same stories, the family started the business in the 1980s, the Bowden family, and they make fruit juice concentrate. And then they have bottlers all around the world who add water and then sell it in stores. And it's delicious. Every fruit flavor you can think of. And they make this stuff in these big vats and tanks and tubes inside these buildings. And it's their corporate headquarters. And I said to the broker, Nick, I said, give me the details. He said, well, they've got 7 years left on the lease and they never want to leave. They're asking if you'll extend the lease for 5 more years right away. And I said, well, if it's going to go residential in 7 years and I extended 5 years, I'm going to have to sit there waiting 5 more years for this thing to mature. Our land cost is $59 a foot, and the comps of land for residential development of condos in this area is $130. So I looked at it and I said, we're going to be into this for $13 million, and as a land play, it's worth $27 million. And I'm going to have a lease for 7 years. And the rent goes up every year. And the company was first bought out by AEA, the Rockefellers, and the Mellons out of New York as a private equity group. They loved the company. And they sold it to Houchins Industries, which is a $4 billion company. And that's who I got as a tenant. And so how do you not buy that? So we decided that we were going to do the deal. And I put out a PPM. And we had our $5 million fund. So we started with $5 million, and I raised $4 million before we closed. And we ended up with the $9 million and the $3.9 million loan. And I got to know the tenant real well. I got to know the CEO of the company. I really liked their story. They can't leave. It would cost them $20 million to leave. And their rent's only $1 million a year. So why would they leave? They can't. They're stuck. They're a sticky tenant. And that's a great pun, because they make fruit juice concentrate, which is very sticky. But you know, you and I have a different meaning when we say sticky tenant. They've been there since 1991, and they're staying 7 more years, and they want 5 more after that. So I went around cold calling in the neighborhood before I bought it. I found out that one of the neighbors is already trying to get residential redevelopment from the local alderman. She's in for a zoning change. And if she gets it, we'll get it. She's like my guinea pig. And I've gotten to know her real well. And one of the investors came over to see it on a Saturday, and the building across the street, the overhead door was open, and we walked in, and I said, hey, you want to sell this building? And they said, yes. So we bought that one too.
So
that's the kind of deal. That's what we do.
So walk me through your thought process. You kind of already did, but in terms of this tenant wants another 5-year lease, it seems like at this point you don't really have any motivation to sign a new 5-year lease at this point. They still have 7 years. You've got time to kind of see how things play out.
I asked them if they would increase the rent if I gave them the 5 more years. I said, I'll tell you what, our current return 7%. It's one of our lower yields on buildings that we buy. And it's because of what it is. I don't need an 8% if it's a great neighborhood where the value is going to go way up. I need an 8% if it's just a regular industrial building and it goes up your typical 3 or 4% a year. So in this case, I asked them, look, your net rent for the 3 buildings is about $1 million. It's a little more complicated than this because there's a couple of entities and they're different buildings. But to simplify it, it's $1 million a year on a $13 million deal. And I said, I'll give you the 5 more years, but I want a 10% return. I want $1.3 million that goes up every year. And they held a board meeting and they said, no. They said, we don't want to pay more. We think if we stay, we should pay less. You're getting a longer term. And I said, yeah, we'll keep the 7 years. And they've been very friendly and we've been friendly. And every time I go there, they give me a bottle of juice. So, and it's delicious. Orange pineapple. So the facts of the case, so to speak, are if it doesn't go residential, I'm going to say it's 99% likely they renew the lease 6 years out or maybe 5 years out, and the rent will keep going up. And that's fine. We're not looking to make a killing and sell it. We like the net rent. We like the yield. We like getting our cash flow every quarter. They pay monthly. We pay the investors quarterly. They like it. We did a cost seg, so there's some tax benefits. And I'm happy with it. I love owning it.
Tell me about your focus on Chicago. So what I didn't mean to come at you hard earlier, but I want to ask you about some other pushback that you get about investing in Illinois and Chicago and Cook County. A lot of people in real estate will say, don't ever invest in Illinois. And if you do, make sure it's not Cook County. What's your justification or reasoning for actually narrowing in on Cook County?
It's about density. I know what you've got, and I know if you own a building in Cheyenne, there's a very limited market. If you own a building in Green Bay, Wisconsin, there's a limited market. There are 3 giant building centers of industrial in the United States. The tri-state area in New York, the Inland Empire in California, and Chicago. The Chicago cap rates are 1.5 higher than either coast in my category of Class B small industrial. That's one. 2, the fresh water in Chicago from Lake Michigan is better than anywhere in the country. The Great Lakes are a huge percentage of the natural water of the world. Food companies need that. A lot of food companies here. Stability, weather. Weather sucks in the winter. No earthquakes, no fires, no hurricanes. The population's very stable. We lose a few people every year, but we're talking about millions of people. And if Chicago had better weather, it would be the number one city in the country because everybody would want to be here. Because except for the weather, and we don't have Broadway, we've got the restaurants, we've got the culture, we've got the lake, we've got the beautiful suburbs, we've got the beautiful architecture. Everybody in the pension fund world knows this is where the rail converges for the entire country, right here in the middle. This is where the tollways and highways converge, right in the middle. Again, the weather and natural water are huge. The population is huge, which means there's a lot of velocity in industrial where if you have a building, there's thousands of potential tenants. My aunt owned a building in De Pere, Wisconsin. She said, sell it. I couldn't give it away. I couldn't give it to the next door neighbor. If that same 20,000 foot building came available in Elmhurst or in Chicago at Belmont and Western, I'd have seven offers and I'd have to say six people are going to be mad at me that they can't have it. We owned a building in New York on Long Island. I had seven offers. So when you're in one of these really highly populated areas where there's huge population, a lot of density, a lot of employees, transportation, culture, and all that, there's a market. And there has to be a market or I can't be there. Some of these other markets, right now, Indianapolis is overbuilt. It's too small. Chicago is the hub of the Midwest. It's the hub of the country. I'm really comfortable with it. And so, yes, Cook County sucks, okay? We have tough government issues. We have bad regulation issues. And all the people who own businesses here couldn't give. They want to own a building right here.
Joel, we're getting towards the tail end of our conversation. I have a few more questions. They're designed to be kind of quick-hitting questions, but if you've got a great story, great info, which I'm sure you do, feel free to take as much time as you want. You talked about raising capital from the one percenters. You talked about Mark and Palm Springs. What's your recommendation, suggestions for people to network with high net worth individuals?
This is going to sound really funny. Go to the cleaners. You know, I live in a community where a lot of one percenters, two percenters, five percenters. And a lot of people who are teachers don't live in our community because they live a little west where they can buy the same size house as they get in my town in Deerfield or Highland Park. They get it for 20% less. But in my area where all these wealthy people live, when I go pick up my stuff at the cleaners, I had a partner named Lou Savage. Remember the Wonder Years and Boy Meets World, those TV shows? So my partner in my original business when I left the Podolskys was Lou Savage. He's the dad of those actors. And he said to me, Joel, I have to move to LA. My kids are on TV. I need to keep my family together. I can't be in Chicago anymore. He said, but I'm going to miss it, man, because I would go to the cleaners to pick up my shirts and pants. And Bill would be there or Mel would be there. And hey, Lou, how you doing? Great, Mel. What you up to? Buying a building in Buffalo Grove and I'm syndicating it. It's a $4 million building. I got this great tenant. Wow, that's great. You taking investors? Yeah. Okay. So Lou says to him, let's go have breakfast tomorrow. I got my cleaning today. We'll do breakfast tomorrow. And then Lou would go and sit down with Mel and have his eggs and bacon and build the relationship and get to know him. And then amazingly, Mel's brother comes in and invests, and amazingly, his children's trusts come in. And then the next day, Lou says, I went to the car wash. It's like if you live in the community where the wealthy people live, they're all around you. You just have to strike up a conversation. And then you get to know people, and then they invite you to their charity events and to their dinners, and then we go out as couples. My wife and I go out with a lot of our friends who are also investors. We took a nice couple. Mark and Andrea wanted to invest in the fruit drink buildings. And they said, we'd like to go into the deal. I said, there's a great restaurant right around the corner. Why don't you and Stacy and I, the four of us, go out to dinner and we'll go at dusk and we'll look at the buildings. We can walk around the outside and then we'll go have dinner at Eden, which is this fantastic, weird restaurant with all kinds of fancy food that they grow in their little garden and their greenhouse. We had so much fun. And that's it. It's the relationships. It's getting together. It's having fun together. I've got Cliff. I said to Cliff, you know, you're a new investor. You were referred in, but we should be buddies. Let's go to the Botanic Garden and take a walk together. So Cliff and I went for a walk. We become really good friends. His live-in girlfriend, Sharon, they're in their 70s. Stacy and I went there for dinner. That's what it is. It's so important to just get to know people. And you know, Dale Carnegie has a saying, nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's what it is. Being curious about them, caring about them, having a nice friendship.
Joel, what's the best deal that you've ever done?
I bought a building in 2003 from the Keebler Cookie Company at 677 Larch in Elmhurst, 100,000 square feet on 10 acres. Keebler had their headquarters there. My friend actually stole the Elf. They actually had the Keebler Elf was in the president's office. He grabbed it and took it with him. So we bought the building for $6 million and Keebler moved out and it had a 600 car parking lot, which is very, very high parking ratio. And we put it on the market. And Comcast was looking for a little call center and a warehouse and a place to park all their Xfinity vans. And they came in and signed a 15-year lease. We had a 15-year deal where our return started at 40% a year and increased after that every year. You know why? User, user, user. If someone needs a building, it's a tool for their business and they needed it. So after 15 years, we sold it to a trucking company called Super Ego Trucking. You've probably seen them around on the highways. They've got 4,000 trucks and he's got a company in Serbia. Guy's Serbian. Toughest guy I ever met. So that was the best deal ever.
Is it typical for you to buy a deal either vacant or knowing that it's about to go vacant after you take it over?
Yes, only all cash. Can't do it with a mortgage, too much risk.
What's your favorite way to find a tenant in that situation?
I go cold calling myself. My son cold calls, my partner cold calls, and we hire brokers in town. We're members of something called the Society of Industrial and Office Realtors. And in Chicago, the industrial market is broker controlled. And we hire a broker and they put it on the market, and I love it when I just get a phone call from Adam, my agent, and he says, "Hey, Joel, I got three people looking at it." Oh, great. Meanwhile, I go door to door. I go to the two buildings, the one on each side, the buildings across the street, and the one behind it that connects by land. So I'm the one who goes actually cold calling the neighbors to see if I can get tenants. We often get tenants and buyers just by walking around.
And so on these deals, are you buying them like a price per square foot basis? Do you understand that? Is it just a matter of knowing what market rent is and the demand and knowing that, hey, I'm purchasing at a great deal, and so if I get market rent for this or even a little below, I'm going to be in great shape?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I know my market. My partners know my market. They know their market. It's intimate market knowledge. That's what it takes.
What's the worst deal you've done?
Oh, I've got a few. I don't know, just have one. I tried to buy some stuff that was going to be redeveloped as retail, one in the city and one in Vernon Hills. I don't do retail too well anymore because I don't do it anymore. I got killed on both of those deals. They were horrible. I'm sticking with my knitting. Industrial, Class B, no retail, no development. I lost well over seven figures of mine and my partner's money on both deals.
What's your lesson from that?
Stick with my intimate knowledge of Class B infill industrial and don't do development and don't put debt on it for me, just for me.
What's your top tip for finding deals?
Networking, brokers, owners. I'd say at least 25% of our deals were cold calls, stopping in and asking people if they'd sell their building.
Joel, this has been a great conversation. I love the industrial asset class. I love what you're doing. I love that you're in Class B, smaller size. That's exactly the kind of stuff that I want to grow my portfolio with. Is there anything that we didn't talk about in this conversation that you want to leave the audience with?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well. I think you're a great host.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Sincerely appreciate your generosity of wisdom, your generosity of time today. If listeners want to connect with you, learn more about you, connect with Britt Properties, where would you like to send people?
Our website is brittproperties.com. That's B-R-I-T with one T. And we've got a lot of good information on the website about what we do and how we do it. and what's available.
Joel, thank you again. It's been an honor and a privilege talking to you today.
Jonathan, same. Thank you.
Listeners, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you so much. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to reach out to either one of us. We love talking about commercial real estate, and we would love to connect with you. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care.
This content is for entertainment and informational purposes only. It is not financial advice, and it is not an invitation to buy or sell real estate or make any investment decisions.